Tokyo Podcast episode number 27.
On this show, we go a little otaku with documentary filmmaker Brad Crawford about his latest documentary focusing on the evolution of arcades and arcade culture in Japan. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, I'm going to be talking to documentary filmmaker Mr. Brad Crawford about his latest film titled 100 Yen, The Japanese Arcade Experience. And Brad's film takes a look at the history and evolution of arcades and arcade culture here in Japan and how it compares to arcades in America. And what's interesting is that here in Japan, public arcades are still extremely popular, whereas in America, I think they've been in decline now for many, many years, which is kind of sad. I think if you're a child of the 80s and you played video games during that time, I think that you'll agree with me that the golden age of arcade video games was from the late 70s to, say, the mid to late 80s. This was a time when, well before the idea of playing a video game at your home was possible. You know, this was well before Nintendo and PlayStation and Xbox and home PCs, for example. You know, as a matter of fact, I remember me and my buddies when we were kids, the only person that we knew that had an arcade at his home was that kid from Silver Spoons. And Silver Spoons was a popular American television show about this rich kid. And actually, I don't even really remember what the show was about, but I just remember he had an arcade in his home. And I remember me and my friends, we just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And some of the fondest memories I have of a child growing up was after school, me and my buddies, before we go home, everybody would go to the arcade. And back then, video games only cost 25 cents. So someone would have a couple bucks from allowance money or some newspaper delivery money or something. And so we would all play video games. And we'd play games like Defender and what did we play? Like Galaga, Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, Double Dragon, Afterburner, all these different kinds of games. And it was a really, really fun time for us kids to be able to have some independence and to enjoy each other's company in this arcade. But what happened in the 80s was that Nintendo introduced the entertainment system. And after that, home consoles started to become the reality, started to become popular. You know, it was possible now to have a gaming system, an arcade in your home. Just hook it up to your TV. So unfortunately in America, as home computers started to grow in popularity and home consoles started to grow in popularity, the public arcade started to decline in popularity. But what's interesting is that here in Japan, even with the massive growth of Nintendo and Sony PlayStation, public arcades are still extremely popular. You can find them all over the place. And one of the more popular style of game is these things called fighting games, where you control this martial arts character on screen and you play and or fight against another character being controlled by another player. And so these type of fighting games are extremely popular in Japan. And every year there's a big competition held in America where all these players from around the world come to see who is the best virtual fighting game player. And the Japanese always do extremely well at these games because they get so much practice here. So if you're into video games and you're kind of like me, you kind of look back on the nostalgia of the arcade, I think you'll really enjoy my interview with Brad. That's coming up a little bit later on in the show. I just wanted to quickly mention that I will be heading back to Canada for a few weeks of holiday next week, actually. I've been away from Canada for almost 5 years now, so it's going to be interesting for me to go back and see what my home country looks like. So while I'm there, I will not be producing the show. So the show will go on break for a couple weeks, but I will be back in April, and I look forward to giving you guys a full report of what's it like to go back to the home country after I've been away for so long. I left Canada in 2007, so it's been a number of years since I've been there. I'm looking forward to going back, looking forward to seeing all my friends again, but I'm really actually looking forward to seeing what it feels like to be back home after so many years away. So I'll be back in April. I'll be looking forward to giving everyone a full report when I come back, but just wanted to let people know that for the next 2 weeks, the show will not be on the air. Today, I'm pleased to welcome to the show Mr. Brad Crawford, who is the director of an upcoming documentary film about the vibrant world of video game arcades in Japan. This film is titled 100 Yen, The Arcade Experience, and is scheduled to be released in early 2012. Hey, Brad, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Now, I am a huge arcade video game fan, and I've been following the development of your video, your film, for some time now, ever since I found it online. And can you tell me and the audience kind of what your background is and why you decided to make a movie about video games?
Well, my background is I graduated with a fine arts degree, which I may not have to explain this to some people, but that doesn't mean a whole lot in terms of what you can do next. Yeah, exactly. So I guess the next phase was deciding to move to Japan. So I did that in 2005. So I lived in Osaka for 3 years, teaching English and doing that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I started making movies and doing photography and that type of stuff. You know, like you have that extra time in Japan. You know, you go out and get inspired by the amazing atmosphere of Japan. And so, you know, coming home back to Canada, one thing I noticed, you know, that we've lacking here that I had in my childhood was arcades. You know, something that just disappeared, like they just don't exist. And being in Japan, I mean, you're inundated with that type of culture. You just, you know, you don't even notice it. It's just like, it's everywhere.
What happened in North America with the arcades? Because I remember as a kid, you know, before Nintendo and all that stuff came out, going to the arcade, I used to deliver newspapers around my area, and I conveniently had my newspapers dropped off at an arcade. So after school, I'd go pick them up and I just play a few games, you know, and then I'd be like, I gotta get out of here and go deliver my papers. But I'd play like Donkey Kong and, you know, like Pac-Man and all those old games. What happened to the arcade scene in North America?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of factors as to why arcades kind of disappeared. First of all, I think it had a really negative image at the time. You know, it was like a place where like the bad kids went, you know, like, right. I mean, like there's like government restrictions on like how you could license an arcade. And there's, you know, lots of different just red tape that they had to go through just to keep arcades running. And then also, of course, home consoles, you know, like with the invention of Nintendo and those types of things, it was just easy to play at home, you know, and in North America, I think, it's viable to have friends over at your house and play video games, you know, like it's common. It's normal. Whereas in Japan, you don't see that often. I certainly can count the number of times I've been invited over to one of my Japanese friends' house, you know, so.
Right. Also, Japanese homes are much smaller. So having a big group of friends over, doesn't work the same way as it does back in America.
Totally.
And you're right. You know, as a kid, kind of the thrill of going to the arcade was, you know, it was kind of a badass a bit, you know, the peep show video games were in the back that you were too young to go check out, you know, but it was kind of in a dodgy area of town.
Right. You know, and it was like, you know, like the people that were there all the time were like, you know, it's kind of shady, right. You know, it had that like dark, like just glowing lights. Like your parents are like, what are you doing spending time at these places? You know, like it wasn't an attractive place to be at the time. So, I mean, it was, as a kid, it was amazing. I loved arcades. Are you kidding? Right. Like, you know, of course I wanted to be there because that was, you know, your parents didn't want you there. You went into video games, you know, just give me some more quarters and let me go nuts. But that can only appeal. That's the thing that they just kind of stopped appealing they didn't try to appeal to an older generation. You know, they always kind of tried appealing to teenagers.
Right.
And that can, you know, it's just not a good long-term business plan.
And then when consoles came out, I think they really realized that it was a lot of older guys who were buying the actual games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Nintendo first came out, I think it was, you know, kind of kids, a little bit older, maybe 20s or so. But as PlayStation took off, games started to get more mature.
Mm-hmm.
I think they recognized there was a lot of older guys with the inner kid
that's right.
who wanted to buy these things.
Totally. And that's just continued to evolve, I think. I think nowadays, like, the 30-year-old market is heavily saturated. You know, like, video games should be appealing to 30-year-olds.
Right.
If they want to, you know, do well. I mean, not at the same time, teenagers and stuff. But retro gaming is a huge market.
One thing I was kind of surprised at, though, in doing research about your film, reading the comments online, is that many people seem to indicate that they wished America had arcades. They're jealous of the arcades in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to see that, because from people who are say, you know, growing up with the home console generation, they actually want arcades in America.
No, yes, for sure. And I think that's, it's just a nostalgia thing. You know, it's you're remembering your past as a kid at as we picture them, these great locations, you know,
right.
And you wish you had that again. And then you see it, you know, that it still exists. And because I think most people don't even realize that arcade games are still even manufactured, you know, like, you just, especially in North America. I mean, you just don't see them. I'd say that's starting to change now, but slowly. And, you know, people, the average person in North America just doesn't even think about arcades.
So anymore. for the average person who's listening to this, then tell us, what is the arcade experience like in Japan?
I mean, it's hard to describe in words. There's some great quotes from the film. When I was asking, I'd ask the same question, you know, describe the arcade to someone who's never seen it before, who has no idea what to expect with the Japanese arcade. And the first thing that people describe is the fact that they're huge. I mean, they're usually 5 or 6 stories tall, if not more. Each floor has its own dedicated game, like, genre of games. We're talking from, like, the first floor is, you know, crane games.
Right.
So you've got, you know, where you can win prizes and things like that. So games that kind of appeal to anyone that just walks even off the street. You know, no problem. Check it out. Have some fun. Spend a few dollars. But then as you go up, you get more and more involved with these things. I mean, you've got, you know, the music games, which is a whole subculture where they're dancing and they're playing drums and guitar and, you know, and there's just tons of, just inundated by music and rhythm things. And then you head up and then there's, like, the mahjong floor where it's just, like, guys chain smoking and, you know, playing away at these card games and things. Then you've got, like, sports simulations, and you've got, like, kind of gambling-esque games with, like, the metal game floors. And then finally, usually have the video games, as they call them in Japan, which are, you know, like, the fighting games,
right.
The Gundam games, the really hardcore genres where these people, like, spend a lot of time playing these things, and there's tournaments and there's events and there's, you know, that type of stuff. So it's like a whole culture. You're walking into a whole, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just like this unique space.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is different between America and Japan is that, you know, in America, rarely do people walk around as much as we do here. You know,
yes.
Everyone drives a car. And so it's one of the things I noticed when I first moved to Tokyo is how much walking I do.
Mm-hmm. I was in much better shape when I lived in Japan. Just because, yeah, you have to walk everywhere. And it's great. I really miss that train-based culture.
Right. And I noticed many of these arcades are conveniently located next to the train station.
Correct. I mean, it's, everyone is in those central areas anyways. So let's put an arcade right next to them. I mean, you're waiting for your friend. You've got like 20 minutes to kill. Perfect. Go play a video game, you know?
It's funny to me how popular these arcades are, considering the amount of electronic gaming gadgets that are available here are huge. You know, this is the home of Nintendo and PlayStation and all the portable devices that they make. And yet you go into these arcades, like you said, and they're just packed.
Yeah, they're, and it's not just young men. It's, you know, the age range. I mean, talking to Taito, one of the big arcade companies in Japan, they tell me that like their age range is anywhere from, I mean, young kids all the way up to 60-year-olds.
Right.
I mean, it's everyone, and it's businessmen, it's teenagers, it's, you know, girls, guys, doesn't matter. Like there's something that appeals to everyone, and they all know about it, and they, it's just like ingrained into their lifestyle. It's right. Part of their lifestyle.
Is there one particular genre of game like dance or shooting or fighting that's more popular than the rest?
I'd say the most popular series is the Gundam shooting games, just in terms of how many people are drawn to those games.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously, in terms of profit, the Claw, you know, the Crane games.
Yeah.
Because they're just, they're first of all, they're money grabbers. And second of all, they're, you know, they're right out on the street. You can't miss them. But the Gundam shooting games are very popular. Fighting games have a huge niche market. I mean, each genre has its own that's the thing about Japan, right? No matter what your hobby is, there's a million people that do it, you know? Yeah. So,
yeah.
So it's,
no matter which one it is, there's always a fanatical fan base that are better than you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I remember when I was in Canada, I'd go to the arcade and a new game would come out, a new fighting game, or, you know, one of my favorite games to play was NBA Jam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Basketball game. I love that game. And, I couldn't believe how fast some of these kids could learn the game.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm working a full-time job, so I'm just stopping in after work. And then some like 14-year-old kid will come in and just kick my butt.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm like, how did you learn that fast?
And imagine an entire country that's able to do that to you.
Right.
Yeah. We don't stand a chance.
Not a chance. I wanted to talk briefly about one of the stars in your film and this whole genre of fighting games, because this is something that really interests me. I enjoyed watching it a lot when I was in Canada to see two strangers, you know, going at it on this fighting game. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the most popular fighting games is Street Fighter.
Right.
And one of the most popular players in this fighting game series, his name is Daigo Umehara. And yes. He's known as one of the world's best what do you call it? Video game fighting champions.
Yeah. I mean, they call him the Beast.
The Beast.
That is his nickname. He is the Beast. And there's a reason for that. This guy, I mean, there's a tournament in Las Vegas every year. It's a professional video game tournament called Evo, Evolution. Every year, 5,000 plus people go and they're all there to compete in these games. So Street Fighter probably gets about maybe 2,000 entrants into the tournament. That's right. Actual competitors. And these guys from Japan come, like Daigo Umehara, and destroy everyone. I mean, like, it's almost not fair.
Really?
Like, Daigo won it 2 years in a row until this year.
Right.
So the past 2 years he won. And the prize pot for this event is something around $20,000.
Wow.
So, you know, he's literally making his living playing video games. I mean, he came to Calgary, Canada to fight in a tournament. I guarantee you he made like $15,000 that weekend.
Wow.
That's all he does. He plays, there was just an interview with him recently that I saw. He said he plays 363 days a year.
Wow.
He takes 2 days off. Like,
why is he called the Beast?
Because he just, like, he can read your mind and he'll, what they call in a fighting game, that he'll rush you down. Like, you can't even play defense against him. Like, he can just tell exactly what you're going to do next. And he, before you've even thought about it, he knows that you're going to do that. So he can just counter your every move you've ever thought of.
Well, a good example of that is that video game match in 2004. Mm-hmm. Did you see that one online?
Are you talking about Justin Wong?
Right.
Yes.
Can you explain to the audience and what happened in that game?
Sure. So, I mean, you need a little bit of knowledge in terms of how the game works. Street Fighter 3 Third Strike. And so there's a move in the game where as you're being hit by the other character, if you hit the forward button at the exact second that you are about to be hit, you'll do something called a parry. And that basically just blocks the move and you get no damage or anything, right? So So Daigo and Justin Wong, another very famous player, are both playing, and Daigo has like no life left, like zero life left.
He's got like one pixel of life left, right? So any hit and he will be dead.
Like even if he just blocks, right, he'll still take damage and he'll die.
Right.
But so Justin does this super move, which you know, hits, I think it's something like 17 times or something. And he literally, Daigo saw it coming. You actually have to parry a second before the first hit happens. Like, it's just, the math is crazy. And he parries all 17 hits. And not only does he do that, but for the last one, he jumps and parries so that he can get a overhead kick, which allows him to get into this crazy combo and do his own super move, which then kills Justin's character. Wow. It's like, I mean, he had to hit the forward button the exact second 17 times in a row without getting one of those wrong. And he did it live at a tournament to win, like in the finals. Like, it's not even, it's not, there was lots on the line for that. And he's sitting there calmly, just, you know, hitting forward at the exact possible right time, you know, like.
It's like the Rocky comeback of video games.
It's fun to watch. I mean, that there's a reason why it has so many views on YouTube, you know.
And I'm really surprised that at these tournaments, there's another one in Japan, right, called the Super Battle Opera.
That's right, Togeki. Yeah,
Togeki.
That's right.
And the one in America is EVO. And yep. I am surprised at how many people show up to these. Like you said, there's 5,000 people that showed up in Vegas.
That's right. I was just there this year and it was insane. Like, it was packed all the time and the people were just going nuts. Like, just, they love it. I mean, and not only were there 5,000 people live, there was something like 100,000 people live watching this streaming over the internet.
Wow.
So it's big.
And are these contests typically fighting games?
These, that especially Evo specifically, and Togeki are all fighting games, yes. But I mean, like, I'm sure people who are in the gaming scene know that StarCraft, you know, gets similar thing. Obviously, it's not an arcade game, but there's, you know, like the esports, as they call it.
Right.
You know, genre has kind of taken off in the last, 5-10 years.
Right. And with these kind of competitions, do the Japanese players dominate?
Oh, I mean, no question. The fighting game community is absolutely dominated by Japanese players. I mean, this year the Japanese player won again. So, like, the last 3 years in Vegas has been conquered by Japan. Wow. And more players from Japan are coming. This year there was almost 20, I think. And actually half of the top eight, four of the top eight were Japanese.
Wow.
So it's a imbalanced field for sure.
Do you think then that with the growth of this, we might see arcades kind of growing again in America?
I think so. I mean, it's like, for example, Round One, which I'm sure you're familiar with in Japan, has now opened a location in LA.
Oh, yeah.
So we're starting to see the Japanese branding of arcades come to North America.
Right.
There's an arcade which is styled around the Japanese arcade in Texas called Arcade UFO, which is owned and operated by a cool guy named Ryan Harvey. Yeah, Ryan Harvey's the owner, and he's really cool guy. He lived in Japan as well, speaks excellent Japanese. And so we're starting to see like kind of a push for this whole Japanese style of arcade in North America. And even beyond that, in Las Vegas, there's something called Insert Coins, which is a new kind of concept. It's an arcade bar. So it's got this massive bar, which is lined with televisions and you can just pick up any game you want at the bar and start playing. It's got arcade machines, like old school arcade games. It's got, you know, new stuff. You can play Street Fighter 4. You can play Marvel vs. Capcom. You can play all that stuff, but you can also just drink and hang out with, attractive female clientele. You know, it's a interesting concept, and I think it's something that North America is going to embrace. So,
well, especially Vegas will.
Yes, especially Vegas.
Tell me about the filming in Japan. What was it like, kind of getting into this culture? Were you accepted? Were the people a little bit hesitant about you putting the camera in their face, or what was that like?
So, I actually went to Japan on my own. I returned to Japan for a month. about 2 years after I'd come back to Canada. And I was just, I had my camera, a microphone, myself, and that's it. And that's how I started filming this project. And at the time, I didn't have any, I'd never done any like communication with any of the companies or anything. So I definitely met a lot of resistance in terms of filming in the arcades.
Right.
It's not something that they want you to do. It's not something that they encourage. And it's definitely something that they try to prevent. So that was a little bit interesting. But upon the release of the trailer that I created, I actually was contacted by Taito, one of the large arcade companies, and Sega had some communication with them as well. So going back to Japan, we went back again with for another month in Japan with a crew this time. So I had myself, I had a translator. I mean, I speak Japanese, but you know, it's always good to have a real translator.
Right.
And I also had another cameraman and another assistant. So we had like a decent crew, and we actually had permission to shoot in the arcades. So that really opened the doors to a lot of opportunities. We were met with, you know, open arms from the community. I mean, we had people who organize events, you know, host us and bring us to these events and really like give us all access and talk to us freely about like what they do and how they've been involved in the community and how it's really, you know, impacted their lives. We talked to, you know, arcade game designers from the 90s, you know, guys who worked for Sega, guys who, you know the culture backwards and forwards and stuff. So we really had a chance. Like, I mean, I couldn't be happier with how things went and how, you know, the opportunities that we were given. People right. were excellent. Yeah.
Are there people still actively building arcade games, like, you know, the big cabinet games in Japan, or are they shifting more to home consoles?
I mean, obviously companies that own arcades like Sega and Taito, and even, I'm not to say Round One is, but definitely Taito's a big player in the arcade market, and they're constantly looking for the next big thing. I mean, I asked them, you know, flat out, what was your best year for profit ever? And they said 2004, 2005. And I said, okay, really? Like, I was kind of surprised it was that recent.
Yeah.
And they said the reason was because they started building arcades. Like, I guess Japan had like a phase where they started building a lot of malls, like Jusco and stuff like that.
Right.
And so they started kind of piggybacking alongside those and started building more arcades. But at the same time, a new genre of game came out, which was like the card game genre. I'm sure you've seen, they have like these icy chips in the cards that you can collect and actually manipulate the cards to play the game.
Yeah, I've seen that. I didn't understand what the guy was doing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Like, tell the audience about that, because you know, that's what, the other thing I noticed that here was a big difference was a lot of the games are more interactive here. Mm-hmm. You know, like back in America, you put the quarter in and you have a joystick and some buttons. That's about it. But I noticed some of the games here. One, you can download your score to your cell phone.
Right.
And then if you go to another arcade in a different part of the city, you just plunk in your cell phone and all your stats are, boom, loaded right in their game, which blew me away. But then, totally. Yeah, I've seen these guys like playing this game, moving these cards around this table.
Yeah, it's this what massive. Was that? It's like almost like a giant touchscreen, but instead of actually touching the screen, you get collectible cards.
Right.
So it's kind of like a, I don't know, like a Magic the Gathering maybe, or like a, you know, like you used to collect cards when you were a kid, you know, that kind right. of stuff. But when you put that character's card on the table, they appear within the game, and then you can move the card itself to move the character in the game. So it's, you know, you make a whole team and you collect better ones, and there's a couple of different genres. There's like a strategy war simulation game where there's like, you know, you're actually manipulating like groups of like soldiers.
Right.
Or there's like a kind of like a Diablo style or like Final Fantasy style. It's made by Square Enix,
right.
where you're manipulating like your RPG group, like magicians and stuff, and you're trying to, you know, defeat the bosses.
Right.
So it's really elaborate, really fun to watch even. And I mean, you'd really have to live there to play that game, because it's like, you know, it's something you have to get into. It's a collectible game,
right,
for sure.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I can see why that would be such a huge seller, because any kind of RPG game like that always does well, I think, if the gameplay is done properly.
Yeah, and then this hits you double, right, with the cards.
The collecting of the cards, right. Totally. Right. What did you find? I'm curious, what did you find about the etiquette inside the arcade? Because I remember when I was a kid, you know, there was kind of like the unspoken rule in the arcade, in that if you wanted to play a game and someone else was playing, if there was a quarter already there on the glass, you knew that someone else was in line.
Right.
Right. And if you're playing like a street fighting game, no matter how badly you lost, you didn't take it out on the guy who just beat you.
Right.
What were some of the etiquette that you saw in Japan?
I mean, it's different with fighting games, especially now. I mean, the way we thought of it was, yeah, you're standing beside the person that you're playing, and then the next person in line takes the place of the person who loses.
Right.
Whereas in Japan, you're actually head to head. So you don't actually even see your opponent. They're on the other side of the arcade cabinet. You sit down, you put your card in with all your stats on it, like you're saying, and you play. And if you lose, you can put another coin in. I mean, if it's busy, usually what happens, I mean, there's usually so, I mean, these arcades are huge, right? So they just have so much. It's hard to get a line to form at an arcade game now because there's just so many of them. But usually it's a courtesy thing, and they'll look around to see A, if there are people waiting, and B, if those people actually want to play or if they're just watching. Because a lot of time I'm just there, you know, chilling and watching people, and they'll look at me and I'll just be like, no, like go ahead, you know. So it's definitely a courtesy thing, but there's no official, like, you know, there's no coin next coin plays kind of rule.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm always fascinated too by watching how people hold the controls. You know, some people cross their hands. Some people grab the controller from the top or from the bottom. I think I saw that Daigo does it. He grabs the controller from the bottom.
That's right. They call it the ume style.
Is it really?
Yeah. And he actually, like, he's a big advocate for that style. Like, he's talked about it many times where he says, like, you know, until I kind of started adapting this type of joystick use, I wasn't as good. So,
right.
I mean, take that for what it's worth. But yeah, he actually grips it in between, I think it's not his pinky finger, but the next finger over.
Right.
And in between the finger and underneath the joystick. So apparently it works. I personally, it's more pinky action in there somehow, but.
But it's fascinating to me, like these little tiny things that you never were, unless you've ever spent much time in an arcade, you would never think that there's this etiquette or these different styles in an arcade. Because when you look at the box, you know, the arcade cabinet, you see a joystick and some buttons.
I know, it's universal, right?
Right? But so you think, how many different ways could you do this thing? But there actually is a number of different styles. And I've seen in your trailer how you can kind of see different players, how they play differently.
Yeah.
And to me, that's just absolutely fascinating.
One of the funniest things that I found when I was doing research for the documentary was with the crane games, there's a whole subculture online on YouTube where there's like these old ladies who are like amazing. They have like all the prizes like categorized. Like they like, oh, if you want this one, you just need to do this. And they teach you like how to win that prize. Like you can go home, YouTube the video, see how to win, and then go back and try your luck.
Really? Eh?
Yeah, like it's strategy. Like it's pretty funny.
Is there some kind of strategy to the crane game? Because I always try that and I never ever grab anything.
I mean, I've heard, I was talking to the Taito people and I've heard they like have like a kind of a list, like an unofficial list of people who are like, you know, not banned, but like when they see them come in, they're like, okay, you know, you can win a couple of times and then you should probably leave, you know, like they're too good, you know.
It's funny how the Japanese just become like experts at anything, you know, like the crane game or dance revolution or something like that. You always just find this group of people who just become fanatical about it.
Yeah.
They do anything and study anything they can to try to master that game.
Oh, it's we met a whole group of the rhythm game players, and they're just, I mean, they're intense. I have this footage of this couple. It's a young girl and a young guy. They couldn't be older than, I mean, they're in their teens still for sure. And the routine, I mean, they're crazy. This is the most insane thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I can't wait to show people this because it's so interesting. They're not watching the dance screen, right? They're playing away from the cabinet, and like he is jumping over the bar while she cartwheels across both sets of buttons, and then he's jumping back on, and they're not missing any beats. It's like just the things that they're able to accomplish while playing the game. I mean, they must have been playing that for too long.
Yeah. You gotta wonder, when did these people have the time to practice this stuff? You know?
I know. It's really fun to watch though.
So do you have any more filming left to do? Is your movie about to be released soon?
Yeah, I mean, we're all done filming. I'm just editing and editing and editing. I've got, I don't even know, terabytes of footage. And so it's I'm sitting at about an hour and 10 minutes right now. It's a rough cut. And so I hope to release the film early in 2012, hopefully February. I mean, sound editing is going to take a solid month. So there's lots to be done, but I don't want to let anyone down. So I'm not going to release something that I'm not completely happy with.
Did you guys do a lot of interviews with like the Japanese video game players?
Yeah.
So I noticed one of the critiques online about your trailer was that there wasn't a lot of interviews with Japanese players.
I'd say 70% of the film is in Japanese now.
Oh yeah.
Well, so cool. It's a lot of Japanese. I mean, as we change our focus towards North America, obviously at the end, near the end of the film, it starts to go back to English, but for the beginning, it's and middle, it's 90% Japanese. So,
when the film is released, where can people see it?
Well, the best place to check out information is on 100 yen. That's 100yenfilm.com, or on our Facebook page at the same name, 100 yen film. Lots of information on Facebook. Lots of information on the website. So, we'll release it there either in hard copy or digital download.
And people can pre-order the video now or the film now, right?
That's right. Yeah. The website's, not the most robust thing in the world, but it's an option. So take a look, you know, feel free to email us if you have any questions. I love hearing from anyone, fans of the film. So I love, you know, getting into conversations. So feel free. We've got, some excellent, excellent musicians involved in the film. I'd like to shout out to Jean Baudin, who's working on some stuff. Check him out on MySpace. His stuff is, there's this one Game Boy remix that is amazing. Definitely going to use that in the film. So his name is Jean Baudin, Jean Baudin. Fantastic. So I'm really excited for like that type of stuff. Like, and we're getting some like chiptunes music. So like, I think the soundtrack of the film is going to be really interesting as well.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing your film because I am a huge video game fan, and I can't wait to kind of see what it's like. I mean, I live in Japan, but I'm still interested in checking it out and seeing what it's like. So if people want to check out more about your video or your film, go to 100yenfilm.com. Thanks, Brad. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Brad for coming on the show. If you want to find out more information about his film, visit their brand new website at 100yenfilm.com. You can check out the new trailer that Brad has recently released. If you're interested in pre-ordering the DVD, you can do so through their Indiegogo campaign, and all those funds will help pay for post-production such as 3D motion graphics, sound editing, and marketing and promotion. So all of the information can be found on his website at 100yenfilm.com. Also, don't forget that next week, Tokyo Podcast will not be on the air as I will be flying to Canada for a few weeks of holiday. I won't be posting a show, but I will be posting pictures and video on my Facebook page. So if you're interested in seeing what my hometown looks like, visit the Facebook page at facebook.com/Tokyo Podcast. If you have a comment or feedback about the show, feel free to send me a message through Twitter at Tokyo Podcast as well. Otherwise, I look forward to a couple weeks of holiday, and I'll be back in Japan in April. So thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.